It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is Trey. Thank you for joining us for a Tuesday edition of our podcast. Our guest today has worked in a variety of jobs despite his youth. He's worked as what I call a special advisor to the president. He may have a different name for what he did. He's worked at the White House. He's worked in our intelligence community. He's an entrepreneur. My friends, this is the highest compliment I can give him. My friends that know him speak glowingly of his, both his ability and his character. He's also really, really young, so I think he's going to be on the political slash governmental stage for a long time, if he wants to be, and I mean that last part on purpose, if that's what he wants. And I say that because it seems to me increasingly there is a clash between politics and spirituality, as I define it, pure, authentic spirituality. Yeah, politics and government seems like a really rough line of work. And religion or spirituality is not often the first or second or even 78th thing we think about when we think about the District of Columbia. But he's at that intersection. So I want you to help me welcome someone whose name you either do know or will come to know, Mr. Cliff Sims, who has a book coming out, The Darkness Has Not Overcome. Do I have that right? I gave short shrift to your background, Cliff. What should I have said that I did not say?
I don't know. I probably couldn't have done it any better than you did. I think that was perfect. The only thing that I care about that maybe wasn't in there was my favorite title of all, which is dad to my six-year-old little boy.
That is the best job of all, although it is a very expensive job, too. I can tell you it is the most expensive form of entertainment. Congratulations on that. So my friends are a motley crew. Some of them, honestly, are just one half step ahead of the law. We were talking before we went on air, a former U.S. attorney, former director of national intelligence, a former U.S. member of the House of Representatives, John Lee Ratcliffe. Kevin McCarthy speaks very highly of you. Tim Scott speaks very highly of you. Ordinarily, when the three of them agree on something, I discard it. I just say there's no way that that could be good or right. And yet they somehow all agree that you are a talented and trustworthy person. So am I guess I'm wrong.
Well, all three of those guys, I think the world of, so that means a lot to me that they would say that. I do find it particularly interesting, though, that every time that you mention Ratcliffe, it's always John Lee Ratcliffe, which is very similar to, you know, there's a lot of three-name people throughout history. You know, John Wilkes Booth comes to mind. Yes. There are others. Lee Harvey Oswald comes to mind. They all killed someone.
Yes.
And so I don't know if we're foreshadowing something that is in Ratcliffe's future at this point, but I could see it. I could possibly see
it. It is not lost on me that with the exception of Sirhan Sirhan, most of the notorious assassins in our country's history had three names. That is actually, I call him by his full name out of respect for his mother. Because I think he was named after the man that introduced his mom and dad, and his late father and his mom. And I just, out of respect for his mom, who quite candidly has had to live with him and know him longer than any of the rest of us, and my heart just goes out to her.
Poor woman.
Can you imagine? The good news is she had a bunch of kids, so some of them kind of helped her, I guess, overcome having a lawyer. that looks like the guy from The Office as one of her children.
Right. So some of her kids did something with their life is what you're telling me.
Yeah. So they weren't the U.S. attorney, the DNI, right. A member of Congress, and who knows what the future holds. Look, here's one thing Ratcliffe has never done. I don't think he comes from a long line of preachers, but you do. So how do you wind up in a line of work that, at least from my cynical viewpoint, would be about as far away from evangelism or proselytizing as you can possibly get? How do you get there?
So I was living in a tiny town in South Alabama called Enterprise. Enterprise is most famous for being the only city in the country with a monument to a bug in its downtown. In downtown Enterprise, Alabama, there is the boll weevil monument, because when the boll weevil came through the South and ate all the cotton crops, it made that area have to pivot to peanuts as their primary crop. And so the boll weevil inadvertently led to their biggest cash crop there being peanuts. So I'm in Enterprise, Alabama, and my Sunday school teacher is a man named Barry Moore. And Barry, at the time, would call himself a garbage man. All he'd done, you know, was run a small businesses and, you know, did a waste management company. Now, of course, we know Barry by his title, congressman. But then he had nothing to do with politics. And it was really a time in my life where I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And Barry decided in 2010 that he was going to run for the state legislature. And he and I had started some businesses together and just kind of gotten to know each other. He's really became like a second father to me in a lot of ways. And Barry basically said, I know you don't know anything about politics, which is true. I probably could have told you who the president was, and that was literally it. I couldn't have told you who our governor was. I couldn't have told you anything else. And he said, I know you don't know anything about politics, and I've never run for office, so I don't know much about this, but I'm betting that if we do it, we can kind of figure it out together. And so I helped manage his campaign in 2010. And then 6 years later, I had an office in the West Wing. So obviously a lot of stuff happened in between there, but that is how I got pulled into politics.
When I read the title of your book, I had two things that went through my mind. One was another book that I read, All the Light We Cannot See. Mm-hmm. And then I thought of the ending of season one of True Detective, which I don't know whether you've seen that miniseries or not, but there's a character who's incredibly cynical. Like, he's an absurdist. He makes Albert Camus seem very optimistic about the future. The character's Russ Cole, played by Matthew McConaughey. But in the end, the very end, he says that he had it all wrong, that light actually is winning the war with darkness. We just can't see it.
Right.
That's what I thought of when I saw the title of your book. Why did you title it that?
Yeah.
And can you make the case that light is winning in politics right now? Because it just seems so dark.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, this is, by all accounts, a pretty difficult, brutal, very pessimistic time in American politics and really in American culture in general. But the title comes from the Gospel of John 1:5, which says the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. And so that's a promise that I think that we can lean on in a time like this. I think it's also worth remembering that when we think about this being such a dark, brutal time in American life, it's often because we have placed politics too high in the hierarchy of things that we should care about. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I've devoted a lot of my adult life, as you referenced, to getting Republicans elected, advancing conservative causes, fighting for a vision of government that I think is most in keeping with God's vision for justice and righteousness in the public sphere. But politics has risen way too high in our hierarchy of things we care about. And I often say the most important moments in world history were Jesus's death and resurrection. Tiberius was the emperor of Rome when that happened. Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea when that happened, but they were not the central characters of the story. Jesus was. And so why then would we make politicians the central characters in our story today? And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, other than the Trey Gowdy show, you know, I'm not watching a lot of cable news. I'm not spending a lot of time reading the play-by-play and you know, Politico playbook or, you know, whatever it is. And I have found that my own happiness is directly proportionate, inversely, with how much time I spend watching the play-by-play of politics.
You know, it's funny you say that. I'm not 100% sure that my wife knows where I was for those 8 years that I was in D.C. She is the happiest person that I know. She spends a lot of time thinking about other people. She was a first grade school teacher. She's up on current events. But like the minute by minute stuff, I mean, I think other than my show, which she says she watches, I'm not sure she could find any other show. I was at a church in Houston, Texas. I have a friend who's a pastor at Second Baptist. And I decided that I was going to see if I could alienate everyone in the congregation at one time, which is really a challenge, but I was going to see if I could do it. So I said, are you a believer who participates in the political process, or are you a Republican or Democrat who attends church? I need to know your primary identity. And I'm telling you, Cliff, it seems to me that the political identity is overcoming certainly the teachings of Christ. I mean, if you look at the teachings of Christ, they're hard. I mean, love your enemies, pray for those that persecute you. I mean, take care of the poor. Those are hard things. So yeah. How do we reconcile that?
Well, it's not easy. And I will say, I am certainly not immune to it. And the exact example that I would give is when I wrote my first book about my time in the White House, President Trump, who I was not trying to attack, I wasn't coming after, I think misunderstood what I was doing with the first book and actually attacked me on Twitter for it.
And the book was Team of Vipers, I believe.
Team of Vipers was the name of the book.
Right.
And when he did that,
I'm shocked that he attacked you on Twitter. You may be the only person that's ever happened to.
I know. It's a very rare thing, a very rare thing. But yes, I'm in an exclusive club. And, you know,
I'm there with you.
When it happened, I was sitting on a television show being interviewed live. And the interviewer said, the president has just tweeted about you. Would you like me to read it live for you? You know, okay, fair enough. And, you know, he goes after me and, you know, to skip to the end of the story, the president and I patch things up. We're great and all is well with the world. But in that moment, as he was attacking me, my answer to them asking me, well, what do you think about that was, my identity is not wrapped up in what Donald Trump says that I am. My identity is wrapped up in who I am in Christ, who God says that I am, and he says that I'm his. And it was the right answer. I meant it, but it masked an underlying struggle that I had with being, you know, talking about the hierarchy of things that we care about, my career and my reputation and my future and, you know, all the things that are wrapped up in that. And it took a lot of wrestling with that reality. It ended up being a very healthy thing for me to have to do to actually get to a point that I could say those words and truly mean them. That, you know, you said, will I be involved in politics going forward? You know, I don't know the answer to that. But the great news is, I don't need it the way that I used to, because you've been there in Congress and dealt with it on a, you know, even a bigger scale than I did. The allure of power, it's difficult to have an appreciation for it until you have it. And then once you have it, it's difficult to let it go. And I remember, you know, C.S. Lewis calls it the inner ring. It's the attraction of the inner ring. or we would maybe call it like the inner circle. And I remember first feeling it when we got to the White House, and I would often walk in with the president in the morning from the residence over to the Oval Office. And when I would get there, waiting for him would be CIA director, director of national intelligence before Ratcliffe was there, you know, the chief of staff, the vice president, his intelligence briefer, and they were getting ready for the president's intelligence briefing for the day. And I would get ushered out of the room, and that door would close behind me. And it sparked inside of me a feeling that I and many White House aides, I think, had during our time there, was this basically a never ending desire to be in the room, in the know, and a part of the inner ring. And I've thought a lot about this since leaving. This attraction of the inner ring is a part of our lives. Throughout our lives, when you're in school, you want to be at the cool kids table. When you're at college, you want to be in the good fraternity, the good sorority, whatever it may be. And then in professional life, we want to rise to the highest level that we can. We want to be in the middle of that. And I remember when it was January 20th, 2021, and I was standing in the empty lobby of the CIA, because it wasn't just a transition moment for our country. It was a transition moment for me. It was like it was going to be our last day there. And I was wandering those empty halls, wrestling with this. And after I left, for months, I felt like nothing that I did particularly mattered. You know, it will never be as important, quote unquote, as that was. And that was ego talking, of course, but it was also wrong. What C.S. Lewis said is, as long as you are governed in your life for that desire to be in the inner ring, you'll never get what you want, because it's like trying to peel an onion. If you succeed, there'll be nothing left. So until you conquer the fear of being an outsider, you're going to be an outsider. The quest of the inner ring will break your heart unless you're able to break it. And so it has been in that wrestling with putting not just politics, but also personal ambition and the things that I want to do in my life in the proper hierarchy or where they should be. And it's an oversimplification, perhaps, but putting God at the center of that has changed everything for me, because the way that God changes us is not the way that most people think. Most people focus on their actions. If I could just, you know, pick a self-help podcast to tell you, you know, you're going to, if you just get up earlier in the morning, if you would just work out a little bit more, if you just eat a little bit better, if you just spend more time with your family, actions, actions, actions. Actually, God changes us in what I would say are like concentric circles. And actions is the last concentric circle. It starts in the middle with what you worship. So if you worship yourself, if you worship power or fame or money, that then becomes what you think about. And what you think about becomes what you desire. And what you desire becomes your actions. And so for me, it started with taking myself out of the center of that concentric circle and my desire for power and fame and money and whatever it may be, putting God at the center of it. And he changed the things I thought about suddenly. And that changed what I wanted in life. And that has changed my actions.
We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy Podcast.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it is hard to top C.S. Lewis in terms of a motivation for having an epiphany. But when I was listening to you describe that story, there is a story in a book written by an author named Stephen Pressfield, who wrote The Gates of Fire and The Legend of Bagger Vance and a whole lot of other books that I've read. And in this story, Alexander the Great, the most powerful man on earth, was getting ready to cross a footbridge. And this little obscure, unknown spiritual leader was also wanting to cross the footbridge, but in the other direction. And so Alexander the Great's men said, "Get out of the way. Don't you know who's coming? He's the most powerful man in the world because he's conquered the world." And this religious leader said, "I'm the most powerful man in the world because I have conquered the need to conquer the world." Man.
Yeah, that's good.
And that's what I thought about, when that you no longer, your identity is not caught up in whatever title you may have. It's not even Yeah, look, I had a friend who was the chief of staff for the president. It's a different feeling when you're in the White House and they walk you in to see. And it wasn't just President Trump. I got to go when there was a Democrat president, too. I guess for some people, that drug never gets out of their system.
Yeah.
And some people realize this is my identity is not caught up in that.
Yeah. Yep. Well, as you're talking, it's making me think about John chapter 6, which is a famous chapter in the Bible because it includes the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000 with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. But one of the lesser remembered verses from that chapter comes after that Jesus's miracle. And the people were so blown away by it that the Bible says that perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king.
Right.
Jesus withdrew to the mountain by himself. And that no one talks about that part of the verse. It's very kind of forgotten. And honestly, I think I may have forgotten it prior to writing the book. But the thing that sticks out to me is the people wanted Jesus to be a king who would conquer earthly tyrants. But instead of conquering an earthly regime, Jesus conquered sin and death and created a pathway to reconciliation with God. And that is the whole good news of the gospel, that God shows his love for us, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And that's just a perfect picture of the difference in the way that we view power and the way that God views power, because they desperately wanted him to come and overthrow the Roman Empire. And that's the kind of king he's going to be. He's like, no, I'm going to do something so much bigger than that, that you can't even understand it right now. But it's hard not to lose sight of that when I think we have a justifiable and very real sense that the country that we grew up in, that we know and love, is slipping away from us. And one of the reasons why Christians in America are starting to experience persecution in ways that they never have in the past is because, by and large, because of the Judeo-Christian worldview that informs so much of the founders' thinking and the way they set up our country, our beliefs, our biblical worldview has been mirrored in a lot of ways by the laws of our country, and has certainly been mirrored in a lot of ways by the culture of our country. But unfortunately, the reality is politics is downstream from culture. And so you don't get changes in laws and policies until the culture has shifted, which creates a political incentive for people in power to then find, oh, this constituency wants this. We're going to change that law or advance a certain policy. And so we have a very real sense that we're losing our country in a lot of ways. And I think that the best example that I could point to of that in recent days is when Amy Coney Barrett was up to be, nominated for Supreme Court justice. And she's sitting in her congressional hearing or Senate hearing about this. And the late Senator Dianne Feinstein says, the dogma lives loudly within you. In other words, I'm worried that you can't be a non-partial jurist because your faith matters so much to you that you're not going to be an impartial, jurist on the bench. How unfathomable would it have been in, before recent years for any member of either party to dare sit up there and say that this Christian probably can't serve in our government because their faith matters too much to them. So I feel like maybe I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. I don't want to downplay the importance of fighting for laws, policies, people to represent us who reflect these values that are so important to us. I want my son to grow up in a country where it is safe to be a Christian, and where he sees that worldview reflected in the leaders that he sees in public life. So I want to fight for that. I just want to keep it in the proper perspective that I've got a lot of friends in countries where Christians are persecuted way worse than they are in America, and Christianity is thriving there because, right, as people see them being persecuted, they still stand strong. They love them anyways. They're willing to go to the hard places and do the hard things. And that's just more important. The eternity is more important than this also important thing of politics in America. It just supersedes that.
Yeah, it takes a lot to surprise me. I was actually surprised when Dianne Feinstein said what she said to Justice Coney Barrett. It's not also lost on me that the media loves to refer to Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden as devout Catholics. Mm-hmm. Now, it's okay for them to be devout. I'm not sure what that word means. But it's hard to read stories where they don't refer to politicians they like as devout. But Mike Pence is an extremist because of his political and spiritual beliefs. And the dogma lives too loudly in a Catholic woman.
Yeah.
So it is. I don't want to get angry thinking about the duplicity of the media. So I will lower my anger and come at you with this. I think it was G.K. Chesterton that said, it's not that Christianity has been tried and failed. It's that it's really hard and therefore rarely tried.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're talking about Jesus in that moment, it wasn't all that long after that. Actually, it took about 3 days for them to hail him as a conquering hero and until they chose Barabbas. A notorious criminal over him. I mean, I tell my friends that lose political races, Jesus lost a voice vote to a guy named Barabbas. So don't tell me you can't lose. I mean, he lost.
Right.
How do we live in the world, but not of the world? How do we care about what happens politically, but not at the expense of our witness or testimony?
Yep. Well, there's a couple of things that I would say to that, and they're all very practical things, but there is no kind of magic trick to it, I don't think, because I've failed at it a lot. I think it really comes down to the people that you have around you living in a community with other people that have shared values that can reinforce those things, when you're starting to get off track a little bit. I mean, one of the things that... we've beat up on John Ratcliffe enough for this podcast. Maybe I'll say something good about him. You know, one of the things that I think that he and you and Senator Scott got right is look at that friend group in D.C. Why is it that this particular group of people didn't lose themselves in the middle of it? Well, I love all of you, but I doubt that it's because any single one of you is of such sterling character that you just are unassailable. It's that you do have good character, but it's also being reinforced by those other people around you. And in a moment where you're struggling, somebody else can say, Trey, what are you doing, man? Like, let's get back on track, whatever. Like, you're around those people that have shared values. And that's where I think it's so difficult, especially in D.C. There are very few people that I think fit that description. I don't want to like discourage everybody because I do think that those people do exist up there, but they're few and far between, and more of them want to go home. I mean, not to give you a hard time for it, but like I can guarantee you, even though you and I have not even talked about this, your quality of life right now is way better than it was when you were in D.C.
A thousand times.
So I think that's what I've tried to focus on is when I went to D.C., it was difficult because the people that are my support group here in Alabama, where I live now, that I see every week at church and that we go to dinner with and that we spend time with our kids playing together, were suddenly gone. And I was on a metaphorical island a little bit there. And that's how you kind of lose yourself. But, there's another question in what you were saying that I talk about a little bit in the book that I think is worth thinking about. The character of our leaders, the type of people that we put forward to represent us, and this conflict that can sometimes exist between their personal shortcomings, whatever they may be, and their policy positions. And it reminds me of or their policy positions, which we may support. It reminds me of going on the noted journalistic enterprise, The View. When I went on The View with the wonderful ladies at The View and got my teeth kicked in for a good 20 or 30 minutes, it was a great experience. After it was over with, Joy Behar pulls me off to the side and she says, "Hey, how could you, a nice guy like you, work for a guy like Donald Trump?" And at first, I kind of laughed it off and kind of told her, "Well, I'm probably not as nice as you think I am, you know." And she said, "Yeah, but you know what I mean." And, you know, we didn't have like a deep conversation about it at the time, but I actually, that stuck with me to the point that I did think about it a lot after the fact. And I do understand what she was getting at, not just with Trump, but for plenty of people that I know and love. The real question is, how can you disagree with some things that a person does, but still support them, or even hate some of their actions, but still love them?
Yes.
And the answer is actually really simple when you think about it. It's easy because that's what I've been doing with myself my entire life. Paul wrote in Romans, "I don't understand my own actions. I don't do what I want to do. I do everything that I hate. I have the desire to do what is right, but I don't have the ability to carry it out, for I don't do the good that I want, but the evil that I do not want is what I keep doing." Paul struggled with this. We all struggle with this. And yet we give ourselves an incredible amount of grace. I still love myself in spite of the fact that I mess up constantly. And I know all the times that I mess up. And yet how rarely do I extend that grace to other people? And I get that question about Trump a lot, someone who I consider a friend now and someone who I support and someone who I've spent a lot of time with and been on quite a roller coaster with him over the last 6 or 7 years. Everything from him being mad at me and suing me to me working for him multiple times to like you name it. And I still love the guy and I think a lot of him. But I will also say there are things that he's done that I don't agree with in his personal life. But Trump was on the policy issues that matter to me, and I think to a lot of believers around the country, he's been great on those things. He was great on the pro-life issue. He was great on putting pro-life justices on the Supreme Court. He was great on telling the Department of Justice that we're not going to go after faith-based organizations anymore, or we're not going to go after someone in the government who doesn't want to abide by certain mandates that violate their sincerely held beliefs. He ended the Mexico City policy of funding abortions in other countries with public taxpayer money. I could go down the list of things from a policy perspective that he was great on. And so while Donald Trump is not the greatest picture of the Christian faith, from a policy perspective, he has been a great supporter of the issues that we care about. And so that's where I land and why I continue to support him and why I've have, you know, Don Jr.'s coming to Birmingham next week and I'm hosting a fundraiser for Trump and he'll have my support and I will encourage all Christians and all people in the country to vote for him again to end what I view as the very real evil that we have in our government right now.
We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy podcast. All right, I got a couple of questions and then I'm going to let you go back to figuring out how long it's going to take you all to replicate the success that Nick Saban had after he left your beloved Alabama Crimson Tide. The rest of us were very, very happy to see him retire, by the way. I think he should have retired 5 years ago, but a couple of things. You mentioned The View. If you had told me before, I've only been on one time. I was supposed to go on with Tim Scott. We wrote a book together. Well, yeah. You know, Tim decides at the last minute that he's going to stay in Washington and vote. He's got his priorities misplaced. So I'm there by myself.
Oh, man.
There's a former AUSA that's on the panel. She used to be a federal prosecutor. That's who I thought would be reasonably fair. Now, this is a book about racial reconciliation. It's not a book about politics.
Right.
Whoopi Goldberg was the nicest person to me, both on and off air. The one that I thought would be fair, because we both used to be federal prosecutors, was not at all fair. So life, I guess, is funny in that way. Here's what I got to ask you. You survey the world. It looks like it is on fire.
Yep.
It is, you know, look, I'm not going to talk about the book of Revelation. I'm not going to talk about apocalyptic things, but it looks like it's on fire. What do you see when you survey the world?
When I look around the world, the thing that sticks out to me the most is a complete and utter lack of credible deterrence. The weakness that the Biden administration has exuded and that, frankly, Joe Biden himself embodies is what has emboldened the bad actors around the world to do what they're doing. And you can look at several of the hotspots. There's obviously October 7th, the Hamas attack on Israel. There's the fact that Putin invasion of Ukraine. There's Xi Jinping breathing down the Taiwanese neck, kind of threatening to take the island by force. There's the chaos at our southern border. Literally, there's not a region of the world right now that is not in chaos. And I think it starts with credible deterrence. So I'll give you a few specific examples. When the Iranians would not stop harassing and killing Americans, Donald Trump said, okay, this terrorist general that I keep hearing so much about, Qasem Soleimani, what's this guy's deal? Oh, well, he operates with impunity. He runs around the Middle East doing whatever he wants to do, sowing chaos in Syria and Lebanon and you know, you name it, Iran, Israelis, he's killing Americans, he's in Iraq going wild, he's, whatever he wants to do, he just operates with impunity. And so Trump says, well, bring me some options for what I could do about this. And so they bring him a menu of options, and it's everything from, you know, the lowest end of that spectrum, which would be, you know, some sanctions or whatever, all the way up to the highest end of that spectrum was, we're just going to kill the Iranian terrorist general Qasem Soleimani. And Trump says, let's do that one. And people freaked out because they were like, you know, well, we show a menu of options, but really we don't pick the things on this end of that spectrum of the options. And Trump says, no, I want that one. Watch. They kill him with a Hellfire missile through his caravan exiting a airport in Iraq. And Joe Biden says, this is going to bring us to the brink of war. Everybody's freaking out. This is going to bring us to the brink of war. Now, Iran starts talking tough and saying, oh, how dare you do this? We're about to show you what we've got. Trump puts out a statement that is forgotten. Trump said, if the Iranians kill an American, I have currently targeted 52 cultural sites in Iran that we will strike with missiles immediately. Now, why were we at 52? 52 was the number of hostages that the Iranians took back in, what was that, the late 70s, early, yeah, whatever. So it references back. Yeah. Remember this other bad thing that you did? If you dare kill an American, I'm going to light this place on fire. Now, what happens? The Iranians send off some missiles that were really more performative than they were trying to, like, kill anybody. And the Iranians get back in their box. And so we don't see anything like October 7th or whatever, because they realize this guy's not messing around. I'll give you another example. Russia. Putin, during the Obama administration, took territory. During the Bush administration, he took people's territory. And now during the Biden administration, he's got the incursion, the invasion of Ukraine. For 4 years, Putin was suspiciously quiet. Now, people say, oh, well, Trump gave him what he wanted. He just would do whatever he wanted to do. He didn't have to take any land because Donald Trump was his friend. That makes no sense whatsoever. Your appetite for your neighbor's property suddenly went away because this other guy said some nice things about you. Like, it makes no sense. And I have to think the reason is Putin surveyed the situation and said, you know, I really don't know what this guy might do. I don't know what will happen if I invade, because he killed Qasem Soleimani. You know, if I look in North Korea, he started firing off tweets about fire and fury, and like the North Koreans panic because he's going to like turn their country into glass. I don't know what this guy's going to do. And it might be better if I just relax for a few years. Let's see how this plays out. And then we can. So my point is that unpredictability and that deterrence that Trump established is what kept peace. And people can complain about Trump's methods all they want. They can not like the tweets or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, his gut instincts for power and the way that it manifests itself in international affairs are bar none the best that I have ever seen. And Joe Biden and all the pointy-headed academics that he has around him can talk about how they know it. You know, you can spin the globe and Anthony Blinken can tell you, put his finger on something and tell you some obscure fact about that country. But Anthony Blinken does not know how to wield power and how to keep people in a box. And neither does Joe Biden. And Donald Trump does. It's just a fact, and history proved it.
But thank God we have Jake Sullivan telling us how quiet the Middle East is just a couple of weeks before right. Hamas starts putting children in ovens and beheading people. I got to ask you about something before I let you go back to looking at the recruiting for Alabama. And we just signed one of your basketball players is coming back home to South Carolina.
I saw that.
So thank you. Thank you for that. We need it. We need him worse than you do. People are going to sit there and think, you know, Cliff Sims, okay. I know he's a New York Times bestselling author. I know he's an intelligence expert. I've seen his name recently. What was it? Oh, yeah, that's right. He was in a story with John Lee Radcliffe about the two people who will run the transition if Trump wins again. I don't know if you happen to see those stories or not. But they made it down to South Carolina. You mentioned that I have good taste in friends. I think it is the gift of discernment. I don't have any other gifts. But if you look at my wife and you look at my friends, I can pick who to hang around with. Yeah. And I can pick who to hire. I will never be the president because that's an elected position, which is something I'll never run for. And you should move. If it becomes an appointed position and they appoint me, you literally should move to another country. But I can tell you right now who I would pick to be the AG if I were the president. I could tell you who I would pick to be the Secretary of State. And I'm never going to be the president, and I could tell you. So the president, President Trump, seems to have a little bit of buyer's remorse about some choices he made in the past. Like maybe a good bit of buyer's remorse. And these are some important slots. So whether you run the transition or not, I doubt you know whether you're going to do it. So I'm not going to ask you if you're going to do it. But the advice for someone on picking the right people for the right slots.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, you're referencing a New York Post article where Don Jr. said the type of people that he would like to be involved include John Ratcliffe and Cliff Sims. So who knows what will happen with all of that. I will help the president any way that I can. But the type of people, I look at it as there being kind of a Venn diagram. People with a proven track record of excellence. A lot of people want to start that with like relevant experience. And in fact, when I first started thinking about this stuff, that's what I would have said as well. But it made me think about, well, shoot, even I didn't have White House experience before I worked in the White House or, you know, went with John to D&I or, you know, whatever. And I know a lot of people in the private sector who are just incredible, and their skill set that they have applied to being a success in the private sector would apply perfectly well to serving in government. People in D.C. want you to think that governing is some kind of superpower that only the chosen ones are, you know, it's bestowed upon them. It's not true. So set that aside. A proven track record of excellence, I think, is first and foremost. Serious people. All right. Serious people who understand the stakes of what we're up against right now and are ready to do something serious. Not self-promotional, who are ready to serve their country and serve their president. And the third part of that Venn diagram is people who support the president's program. One of the biggest problems in the first iteration of the Trump administration is you had some people who were, you know, whatever, they were serious people. They had a track record of excellence, but they had fundamental disagreements with the president's policy priorities. And the examples that I would point to with that are you had some people in the first administration who were not on board with the president's trade agenda. The president believes in reciprocity in trade and in the use of tariffs as a tool to bring reciprocity and fairness to international trade. And you had some self-avowed, total kind of open free traders who didn't like that, which is fine, except for when it became time to implement the policies that the president wanted to implement, they would slow walk them, undermine them, and in some cases just flat out not do them. Another example would be the president's foreign policy, where he felt strongly that we should get out of Syria, get out of Afghanistan, some of these places. Now, these are policy issues on which we can disagree. Even inside the administration, let's have a really strong discussion about these things. But when the day comes that the president of the United States, who was elected by 100 million Americans out there, decides we're going to do this, either execute that or get out, undermining the president and not implementing his, you know, perfectly legal orders is not acceptable. And so that's kind of the three parts of the Venn diagram that I'm thinking about, the type of people that we want to have there. And in the very middle of that is the character question and pulling together a team of people, not looking at these, you know, different jobs in silos, but pulling together a team of people that all fit those, you know, those overlapping Venn diagrams. I think that Donald Trump has the ability to pull together the best, most talented government that this country has seen in a long, long time. The people who are coming to mind for you, coming to mind for others, are willing to serve. I think people would actually be surprised at the people who are willing to serve and want to serve under President Trump. And we can get this country on back on track and make the changes that need to happen in a hurry before this thing is a runaway train that we can't stop anymore. But if I were to have any role in a transition or have any input on any of that, that's kind of how I would be thinking about things.
Yeah, I tell my buddies that are in, you know, the bosses of their offices, that same thing I used to tell my folks, I have earned the right to be wrong. I want you to tell me if you think I am wrong, but I have earned the right to be wrong. I mean, ultimately, it is the president's policies that are implemented. And if you That's don't right. agree with them, then you don't need to serve him or her.
That's right.
You are welcome to have a different view, but you either, I kind of liken it to, you know, look, prosecutors have to enforce laws that they themselves would not have written.
Yeah.
It takes a certain humility to be willing to do that, to say, look, I'm going to subjugate myself. But look, I could talk to you all day long. You've already written one New York Times bestseller. I guess you're going soon to be number two. Is it out? Can you get it? Where is it?
Yes, it's out today, May 7th, and you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, you name it, anywhere you get books online or in physical locations, it is out there, and I would love the support. And I think, you know, this book is obviously important to me, and it's got a lot of my stories in there, but I think it's also an opportunity for people who of faith, believers out there, who want to support something in the political space to kind of send a message that, like, hey, this is what we're about. This is what we're about in the marketplace. I think it's an important opportunity for that, because I will say I had a really hard time finding a publisher that wanted to touch that cross section of politics and faith. And I'm not sure they believe in it. And I just believe there's a huge overlap in those two audiences and people that want more content like this. And so I would love the support and obviously appreciate you having me on to talk to your audience today.
At least in the circles I run in, maybe it's just because I run with, you know, for the most part, with the exception of a couple of lawyers, a pretty good group. They are fascinated by the intersection of faith and politics, and particularly what the role of believers should be, should not be, is they're fascinated by it. And the fact that you can write about it, well, as the, you know, coming from a long line of preachers, you obviously you know, when you quote Bible verses, much like Tim Scott, I actually think you're quoting the right verse. I have other friends that I don't even think they're close to being right. I think it's like the lyrics from a U2 song. I don't think it's in the Bible, but I think actually you're right when you tell the story. So I wish you every success. I have a sneaking feeling that you're going to have a decision in the future about whether or not you're going to be able to stay in Alabama. I think somebody's going to try to drag you back to another place, but time will tell, and we will see. We will see if you're asked what the voice tells you to do, whether to step back. You seem remarkably happy in Alabama with a boll weevil statue close by. We shall see what the future holds. I wish you all the best on your book tour. And I thank you for, I found the last 40, however many minutes to be fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Trey. I really appreciate it, man.
Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.